From Greensburg to Reading, Uniontown to Jersey Shore, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, radical environmentalists are attempting to do by regulation what they can't get done by legislation: impose a job-crushing cap-and-trade tax on Pennsylvanians. Gordon Denlinger from the National Federation of Independent Business is here with details. In Pittsburgh, county and local government got involved in a private sector activity, opening a grocery store. It hasn't ended well. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi have this week's Allegheny Institute report. And Pennsylvanians already pay the highest gas taxes in the nation. And if a proposed federal gas tax increase passes, we will pay even more. Anna McCausland of Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania has a Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Gordon Denlinger in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. The white-hot Trump economy has given Pennsylvania its lowest unemployment rate on record. Now, that statistic has only been kept since 1974, but last month, the state's unemployment rate dropped to 3.9%, the lowest ever recorded. In addition, the state's labor force, the number of people employed, grew by over 5,000 new jobs to another record high of 6.2 million persons employed. These numbers are from the Pennsylvania Department of Labor and Industry. All that is good news. However, it is causing problems for employers. The Spring 2019 Keystone Business Climate Survey, conducted by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, found that 71% of the employers responding are having difficulty finding qualified workers. We'll have more on that on next week's program. On the political front, U.S. Senator Robert P. Casey Jr. is lobbying to have one of the Democrat presidential primary debates held in Pennsylvania. Casey is asking the Democratic National Committee to hold one of its debates in Penns Woods, arguing the state is key to winning the White House in November. President Trump carried Pennsylvania in 2016 en route to his upset win over Hillary Clinton. Congressman John Joyce, who represents a sprawling district centered in Altoona, recently visited the nation's southern border and returned saying he was, quote, stunned by conditions he found there. Joyce said it was an eye-opening trip and that the illegal immigration crisis along our border is real. He said Congress needs to fix loopholes in the nation's asylum system, provide adequate manpower and technology at the border, and build the border wall. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. A state regulatory board is attempting to impose a costly cap-and-trade program on Pennsylvania energy consumers. The cost would be enormous and would make our state's business climate even less competitive than it currently is. Here to explain what a cap-and-trade program is and why it would negatively impact job growth in the Commonwealth is Gordon Denlinger. Gordon is Executive State Director of the National Federation of Independent Business here in Pennsylvania. Gordon, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Gordon, before we get into the history and the specifics of what is being proposed here in Pennsylvania, when we use the term cap and trade, what are we talking about?
Cap and trade is a term of art that relates to capping the emissions of a certain pollutant, be that some type of gas or other pollutant. So placing a cap and then trading allowances or credits underneath that cap between entities back and forth. So folks buy and sell credits or allowances under the trade mechanism with cap and trade. So it's a combination of an attempt to limit pollutants, but also some free market forces interjected into it.
The end result of that, though, ends up being essentially a tax on that business, doesn't it?
It does. And at the end of the day, these credits, these allowances that are purchased, those costs are borne by the ultimate consumer of the goods, you know, be that electric as a service or production of goods. So yes, absolutely, there is a cost related to this that is passed on down. And there's a cost to the manufacturer in attempting to comply, because cap begins as the setting of a level that then is ratcheted down over time. And the only way to deal with those realities is advances in scrubbers or equipment to try to take the pollutants out of whatever emissions are released. So there's the cost of the equipment. There's the cost of the credits themselves. It is costly at some level. And yes, to your point, absolutely, that is passed along to the end consumer.
Let's take a look back now, Gordon. This is not anything new. There's a history to this sort of effort to not only ratchet down pollutants, which in some ways is a good thing. I mean, obviously, we all want clean air and we all want clean water. The question is, how do you do it in an efficient way that does not put businesses out of business and people out of jobs? So tell us a bit about the history of cap and trade.
Cap and trade, interestingly, goes back into the 1980s and the Reagan White House, where Boyden Gray, Esquire, Boyd Gray, was a conservative lawyer seeking to move the bar forward, the needle forward, on an issue by, I guess you'd say, standing against the bureaucracy and the command and control nature of EPA, just basically clobbering people over the head, and move toward compelling people through market forces to try to move them toward behavior that maybe they otherwise would resist. So cap and trade was conceived in the Reagan White House, but it really didn't get its start per se until the Clean Air Act of 1990 and President George H.W. Bush 41, he signed that legislation. And you know, as he ran, and some of us recall, he put forward that he would be the environmental president. That was part of his push. And to try to put some substance behind those words, the Clean Air Act of 1990 instituted the cap-and-trade mechanism for sulfur dioxide. Sulfur dioxide, the primary component in acid rain pollution. And so in an attempt to try to get a collective solution to acid rain, which was a significant issue in that time frame, the cap-and-trade mechanism was put in place. The first reductions under it occurred in about 1995, and to this point, we've seen about a 50% reduction in sulfur dioxide emissions and a significant improvement in the acid rain situation. So there is certainly a success story connected to this and some interesting free market forces that were deployed to try to get to a solution that was not, again, just heavy hand of government command and control oriented. So it's a compromise solution between conservative free market types and the environmental folks on the other side.
We are talking with Gordon Denlinger, who is the Executive State Director of the National Federation of Independent Business for Pennsylvania, talking about cap and trade and the fact that there is now a proposal to bring that program, that set of regulations, essentially taxes, to Pennsylvania. So, Gordon, tell us what is being proposed in Pennsylvania and where is this discussion being held?
The second part of your question there, I think, is a big issue. This is being held purely within the bureaucracy, away from the legislative process, are attempting to move this forward without the voters and their elected representatives and senators weighing into the equation. But stepping back a little bit, what's being proposed here is an attempt to go after greenhouse gases, GHGs, which are thought to contribute to climate change, to global warming, attempt to reduce these gases in such a way that we can affect change. And they're the environmental side are reaching back to the success story of the acid rain situation, which I just shared, to try to use that mechanism again and employ it here in Pennsylvania. Now, I should step back and say Pennsylvania is part of a 10-state plus District of Columbia compact that is a state-by-state attempt at a solution to the extent that governors such as ours, who's been rated the most liberal governor in America, are unsatisfied with the EPA federal level efforts around greenhouse gases. There's an attempt to put state-by-state solutions in place. So what we're seeing is the Pennsylvania version of that being pushed by Governor Wolf. And it is, again, a cap-and-trade mechanism, so capping greenhouse gas emissions, mainly carbon dioxide, coming from power plants and all sources, and an attempt to move us to zero emissions, absolute zero, by year 2052. So they would set the emission levels at 2016 levels, and as of 2018, the first year of enacted measurement, and obviously we're a little beyond that now, but they would begin a 3% reduction in the cap year over year. And if you do the math, it works out to 2052 being the year of zero emissions. So it is an extreme measure to get to zero. Wow. I mean, we're going to be living in caves or something like that. I mean, I don't know how, you know, society functions at zero, but that's sort of in the age of the Green New Deal. That's the mentality and the thought process.
In terms of all of this radical environmentalism, you mentioned that this is trying to do this through the regulatory deep state bureaucracy in Pennsylvania rather than through the legislature, which, in my way of thinking, is that good old taxation without representation. You may recall a couple hundred years ago, we fought a little war against England because of that sort of thing. So now here in Penn's Woods, where all this liberty began, is it really possible for this sort of a draconian program to be implemented by regulatory fiat, Gordon?
Well, if you're a constitutionalist, you would have to say no, absolutely not. This is way beyond the grant of authority that agencies are given. They are given some latitude to implement directions from the assembly to fill in the details, if you will. But this is not just filling in minor details. This is a radical, complete shift. And the idea that this would not be fully vetted before the elected representatives of the people over a period of time, given a complete hearing, I think is just horrendous. It's deeply concerning, and I would hope that the courts would prevent this, but you know, here in PA, we have a radicalized Supreme Court as well, and so who knows? We may have to go to the federal court system to try to get some relief, but this is the game. They are attempting to take it around the back door, if you will, and avoid the direct impact of having the people weigh in, the people getting a voice and a vote connected to this.
Is it possible for the state legislature to step in and put a halt to this regulatory hijacking of the issue?
I would think they could, and that's typically done with the power of the purse. You would just defund or cut whatever strings financially would be behind all of this. That's at the federal level. That has been done many times, could be done at the state level. More likely, you'll end up into a series of lawsuits that would go after this. And that could be legislative leaders, the head of the House, the Speaker of the House, and the President pro tem of the Senate entering a lawsuit to go after the executive branch on it. That tends to be happening more and more these days as these overreaches keep occurring. So different ways to go after it. But at the end of the day, all eyes need to be on this. We need to be vigilant. And folks need to realize that the far left environmental lobby is attempting to hijack our government and take us down a road of extremism that will literally destroy our economy and our way of life.
Gordon Denlinger is Executive State Director of the National Federation of Independent Business here in Pennsylvania. Gordon, tell us just a little bit about NFIB. Also, where can folks go if they want to go on the web and learn more about this issue?
NFIB is the voice of small business. We're the advocates fighting for the mom-and-pop businesses. You know, the corner deli, the card shop, the hardware store, folks who are living the American free enterprise dream, and they need voices in Harrisburg and in Washington. And that's us here at NFIB. It's a membership, bottom-up driven organization, and I'm thrilled to be their state director here in PA. To get to us, we're as easy as the internet, nfib.pa.org. We'll get you to NFIB and encourage your listeners to check us out and consider becoming a part.
Gordon Denlinger from the National Federation of Independent Business. Gordon, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
A grocery store in Pittsburgh's Hill District was developed partially using taxpayer dollars. Now the store is shuttered and in disrepair. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi look at how this happened on this Allegheny Institute Report.
Hello and welcome to the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm your host, Frank Gamma, and with me today is Allegheny Institute Research Director Eric Montardi. We have a topic we'd like to talk about that we typically don't hear on our report, and that is local development. Specifically, here in Pittsburgh, we had a grocery store being developed in a neighborhood in Pittsburgh that hadn't had one for like 20 years or so. And it was put in with the use of some public dollars. So why don't you give our listeners a little background on how this all came about?
Sure. Way back to 2008 or so, the Institute started some research on a proposed grocery store for the Hill District, which is just up the hill from where the Civic Arena used to be. Still up the hill from now where PPG Paints Arena is.
And for those older listeners, where Hill Street Blues was set.
Yeah, right? And there's a couple of proposals to put a grocery store in. Some were, you know, not as many as you'd say bells and whistles, you know, maybe just like a bare bones type grocery store. And then there was other proposals where it'd be more expansive and more extensive. And what ended up happening was they built a plaza and they did put a grocery store in. And that involved, as you mentioned, some public subsidies, also some foundation support, some private interest support. And basically, what developed into maybe like a $10 or $11 million project opened in October of 2013. And earlier this year, we started to hear some rumblings and there was some, you know, newspaper coverage that there was issues between the grocery store operator and the landlord, which is a nonprofit organization in the Hill District, that there wasn't maintenance being done on the plaza. There was, you know, other tenants in the plaza that said that the grocery store wasn't attracting the foot traffic that they, you know, thought would be there originally. Complaints about the selection in the store. On and on and on. I mean, who knows what really the story was? But basically, again, from a public policy perspective, what we looked at was, well, you know, what specifically went into the project? Where does it stand? Where did it stand, you know, a month ago or so when these reports started to come out? And what is the, you know, where does the future go? So basically, after digging into what was there and what was provided for the store, out of about $8 million in leveraged loan and grant sources that we were able to identify, 54% of that came from the government. Now, we're talking federal government. Right. State government, the county, Allegheny County, and then the city's Urban Redevelopment Authority. They put in over half of that amount into the project, again, to get the plaza built and to get things established. And then there was other parties that came into it as well from the foundation and private community as well.
Wasn't that part of, again, you mentioned the Civic Arena for our own listeners, not in the Pittsburgh area. That's where the Penguins played. Has been replaced by what's now called the PPG Paints Arena. And of course, as a condition of getting the arena and the money for the arena, the Penguins were required to put in some public money into projects around the area. And I believe one of them was, of course, this development, which was not too far from their home, their former home. And so, you know, this is kind of one of those situations where this was meant to be a public-private partnership with the team and with everybody having input. And sometimes everybody having input means that everybody had input, and a lot of things tend to be delayed and as arguments go back and forth. But the one group that oversaw this whole thing was what we called the Hill House. The Hill House Community Development Corporation had quite a few assets, but, you know, of course, they came under some of their own issues lately with not being able to properly fund their mission, their organization's mission, and what they needed to do, in of course, including taking over and taking care of the property that was the grocery store development center, Hillman Plaza, I believe is what it was called. And of course, you did some work on the property taxes in there, and what'd you find?
Yeah, this was really surprising. So the plaza itself is owned by an LLC. But again, as you mentioned, Hill House, and it has an EDC and a CDC. It's got other functions that operate out of that nonprofit. We, just looking at the county website, because this is a taxable property, even though it was owned by a nonprofit, this was something, the plaza was taxable in nature. They had not paid their county real estate taxes back to 2015. Then after doing a little bit more digging and finding out, because you also have to pay, you know, city taxes and school district taxes, those taxes had not been paid as well. So as of the end of March, we're talking about a $200,000 unpaid property tax bill combined with some liens on it. And basically then hearing all these problems with the nonprofit and their finances, at the same time that this was going on, they were trying to sell for their properties, not including the plaza. But then as things kind of accelerate and, you know, the news cycle goes, It ended up now where things stand is that the Hill House plans to close completely as a nonprofit organization at the end of June. And now they're selling off all their properties, which include three more, which one of them is the Plaza. Right. So again, now we're talking about a very large piece of property in relation to what else they own with an assessed value of around $2 million and unpaid taxes. So presumably, they're hoping that somebody's going to buy all these properties. They're going to settle any kind of tax bills that are in arrears and pay the liens. And then, you know, somebody else is going to be operating presumably a grocery store. And that's what brings us now to, you know, well, what happens going in the future?
Oh, sure. Again, you get to this point where, okay, public money built this development with the grocery store in it. And so there was a lot of finger pointing as to who was responsible for taking care of it. The owner of the grocery store and the coffee shop said, hey, wait a minute, it wasn't our responsibility to take care of it. The Hill House was supposed to take care of it. The Hill House said, well, you know, we don't have the money for it. You take care of yourself. And the finger pointing led to a lot of name calling, I'm sure. And the end result is the grocer threw his hands up in the air and says, I'm out of here, and closed the doors. And so the, now the question comes up. What's the future look like? So if you had to put your Kreskin hat on and look into your crystal ball, what do you think's going to happen?
Well, I mean, it sounds like they want to have another grocery store there. Mm-hmm. There's this big development. We come back again to the Civic Arena because when the Penguins got the development rights to the old site, which is now just surface parking, they're basically going to be doing another type of city development that's going to connect from the Hill District down to downtown Pittsburgh. And there's a lot of things that are going on there. So it sounds like at this point, well, there's going to be the population. Mm-hmm. There's going to be the interest that we're doing enough things. You know, the public hand is kind of involved again down on the Civic Arena site that somebody should just take this grocery store and just run it. On the other hand, we've heard, well, yeah, we kind of paid for the brick and mortar cost and that's taken care of, but we also have to figure out some financials of getting an operator into the store. Right. But we've heard from a lot of the public officials that they've talked to chains that are in and around Pittsburgh, you know, grocery store operators, franchises, and said, yeah, we're interested in the site, but nothing concrete yet. Other than by one was the member of city council that said, yeah, there's interest, but it's going to be 6 months to a year. So there we're looking end of 2019, possibly into 2020 before somebody says we're putting a store in there, whether it's with public support or not. Right. You know, we don't know. But obviously, it'd be better if there wasn't.
Oh, sure. Yeah, subsidizing retail is certainly poor public policy. If the demand for a grocery store is evident, then a private grocer should come in and operate it. So if the promise of more people in the Civic Arena site and development is going to result in a demand, let someone else fill that demand. So I'd like to thank my colleague Eric for joining me today. I'd like to thank our listeners for tuning in. If you'd like to learn a little bit more about this or any of our other topics we cover, please visit our website at AlleghenyInstitute.org. Thank you for listening.
Congress is considering another increase in the federal gas tax, further adding to the energy tax burden of the average American. Anna McCausland of Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania has this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
Earlier this month, Americans for Prosperity released a report that details the impact of the proposed gas tax currently being considered in Congress. This plan would increase the gas tax by 25 cents on top of the 18.4 cent current tax rate for a new total of 43 cents per gallon. This may not sound a lot, but that isn't the only tax on the fuel you use. States also assess gas taxes, and Pennsylvania's is the highest. If you've lived in the state since 2013, you probably remember the news stories detailing the largest tax in our history being passed. The $2.4 billion gas tax increase has been phased in over multiple years. Pennsylvania's tax at 57.6 cents per gallon is still the highest in the nation, beating out traditional high-cost fuel states like California and Hawaii. Their fuel may cost more per gallon because of other factors, but it isn't taxed more. While the Pennsylvania gas tax bill was sold to constituents as needed to fund dilapidated roads and bridges, more than half went to pay for many other things. Former Representative Steve Bloom from Cumberland County authored a bill that would have directed the money first to roads and bridges that needed repair, but that bill was rejected. In the end, only 1.5 of the $2.4 billion increase funds roads and bridges, whether state or given to local municipalities for their road and bridge work. It's true. Pennsylvania's infrastructure has challenges. According to the most recent edition of the Pennsylvania Highway Statistics Report, released by the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation, PennDOT, the state highway system is made up of over 120,000 miles of roads. Ours is one of the largest systems owned by a state. Another 78,000 is owned and maintained by local governments. We do have a freeze and thaw cycle, which means the ground doesn't stay frozen through the winter. It's constantly warming and refreezing. That wreaks havoc on pavement. To better pay for repairs, it would make sense to prioritize spending to roads and bridges. However, not every dollar of Pennsylvania transportation funding goes to roads and bridges, and it's the same for the federal highway transportation funding. More than 28% of funds from the Highway Trust Fund are currently diverted away from roads and bridges. Still, more taxpayer dollars are wasted on inflated costs due to outdated regulatory burdens, a complex and sluggish permitting system, and overly restricted labor requirements. From the report, quote, "Taxpayers have no reason to believe that these practices will stop the higher gas tax. In fact, those behaviors may even accelerate with new revenue," end quote. Pennsylvanian households will spend $250 more per year to fund the proposed gas tax. Beyond mismanagement and corruption, and direct costs to your wallet alone, the report reminds us of the true impact of gas taxes, increasing the cost of nearly everything we purchase. From the things that are delivered on a truck, or a local UPS carrier from Amazon or other online retailers, to the groceries that we drive to the grocery store to purchase. In Pennsylvania, if this plan were to pass, we'd spend $1.02 on every gallon we pump into our vehicles and taxes. For my 18-gallon SUV, that's $18.36 in just state and federal taxes, pushing my weekly fill up to $60 or more. I chose to buy an SUV to cart around my family and all of their stuff. I mean necessary car ride essentials. But what about the 5 million people in Pennsylvania that are classified as living in poverty or poor? When I filled my tank last week, the person before me spent only $10. At $2.95 per gallon, that was a little over 3 gallons of fuel. That doesn't take you very far. If this tax is increased, that $10 will buy less gas, and $3.06 will be taxes alone. So what should men and women in Congress consider to use current dollars to go further? 5 points from the report. 1, preserve federal infrastructure dollars for targeted construction projects of a national priority. 2, unleash private investment in infrastructure assets. 3, return power and responsibility to the states where possible. 4, overhaul the regulatory and permitting system to improve outcomes and efficiency. And 5, eliminate costly and unfair labor restrictions. Please go to AmericansForProsperity.org and sign our petition against the gas tax. Your voice is the best tool to be used to put Congress on the right path. I'm Anna McCausland, Deputy State Director with Americans for Prosperity. Find us on Twitter at AFP Pennsylvania and on Facebook, facebook.com/fightback for our national organization or facebook.com/AFPPA for our local PA chapter.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 24 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WCCS-AM and WLCY-AM in Indiana, along with WFYL-AM in Jeffersonville, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, and the Worrell Foundation of Carlisle. All of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.